I still remember the day when I took the train. I was all of 17, sorry, 13, with my mates, went down to Cooper's Plains train station to go to Hoyts in the city, back when there was quite a few Hoyts cinemas. I watched Terminator 2 Judgment Day. All right, can I get a show of hands? Who has not seen Terminator 2 Judgment Day? Oh, you guys are missing out. Let me tell you. All right, for this 13-year-old back then, and I think for this 42-year-old still, it was the best movie I've ever seen. With Arnie's biceps popping out of the screens, 2.5 hours of non-stop action and explosions, and the premise of the movie, machines gaining consciousness and rising up against their human creators and overlords. Did I mention the action? In a race against time to prevent the nuclear holocaust that was to be Judgment Day. Now, I still think it is one of the greatest movies of all time and a must-see. And for me, growing up without Jesus, I came from a non-Christian family, it introduced the idea of Judgment Day. Judgment Day. You see, prior to seeing the movie, I've never heard of it. I didn't go to RE at school. I didn't go to a Christian school or anything like that. It was an idea that was brand new. This idea that one day there's a disaster is going to happen. It's going to change the world forever. I didn't quite know why it was going to be judgment and why it wasn't just disaster day, but it's judgment day. But I was soon to find out a few years later when I was at university. Someone very kind of kindly and naively invited me along to a Christian talk at uni, all right, where someone opened this very passage. So if this is the very first time you've come to church and listened to a Bible talk, that's kind of me all those years ago when someone opened Romans 1 for me. And when someone broke the bad news that Judgment Day isn't kind of ahead, judgment is already happening. The bad news that Paul breaks for us is that judgment is personal, from a personal God who calls everyone to account. Now, by that stage, 19-year-old me, I was thinking, how could that be? Judgment Day, what? Like T2 and all that sort of stuff? The world's just so normal, right? There's no robots going around blowing things up. There's no crazy car and truck chases, no explosions. Everything is just so boringly normal. How could we be under judgment? I mean, we all have tough days, annoyances, someone cuts us off at the lights. But for us, it's all much easier to believe Louis Armstrong, that it's a wonderful world, than to believe the doomsday prophets. And yet, again, as we look at the passage today, we will see Paul affirming the fact that our world is indeed in trouble. There is actually a conspiracy of silence about God. And as such, the world is under God's wrath and judgment. Before we let loose with that, before we do that, we need to start with a context. Now, every passage in the Bible has a context. We finished last week's passage in these stirring verses. So if you have your Bibles open, please have them open with me. And your notice sheets will be very, very useful. Let me tell you why else it'd be useful. There's a tear-off section like this that if you're joining us for the first time and you'd like to join our church family, here is a section that you can leave us your details so we can get in contact with you, let you know what's happening at church. But also on the other side is a comments, requests and prayer points section. Now you can write down both questions that might come out from today's talk or other things that you might have noticed in the service today, or you can simply just let us know what sort of things we can pray for you about. And all you do is simply tear that off, all right, and put it in the yellow box down the back. And the other thing this is useful for as well is there's a sermon outline on the back that'll help you to know where we are. So let's have a look at the context. We finished here last week in chapter 1, verse 16. Paul says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. For in the gospel the righteousness of God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith, from first to last. Just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith." The wonderful news is God's righteousness has been displayed. It's been shown in this thing called the good news, the gospel. Okay, now that's good, right? Salvation, okay, sounds cool. But salvation from what? Why do we need this gospel in the first place? Well, the answer's in our passage, because And point one on your outline there, in verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed. Chapter 1, verse 18. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. If you look at those verses that I've just read, those three verses, verses 17 and 18 are almost parallels. It's like Paul saying that while the gospel is this wonderful revelation from heaven of God's righteous character and his righteous actions in saving us, well, that's all really good. It's necessary because his wrath is also being revealed as well. Now, wrath is a funny word, isn't it? When did you last use the word wrath? All right? I don't know, talking to your kids at the dinner table. You know, be careful of my wrath. All right, if you do not eat the broccoli. It's a funny old word, isn't it? Like, Paul simply means anger, but a particular form of anger. That it's that reaction when we kind of see something or come across or have something wrong happen to us. Something that is particularly deliberate and perverse. So when people are cruel to animals right in front of you, when bullies pick on the weak, right, in the schoolyard, when thieves break into your home and take what does not belong to them. See, multiply that by a million, and you're just starting to come close to God's anger. But what is God angry about? What is he so wrathful about? And is he right to be angry? Well, Paul puts it this way. God is angry at the state of our world because the truth about him is suppressed. Let's read verse 18 again. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Paul says, here's what's going on right now. People everywhere have two basic problems. Whether they realize it or not, they are ungodly and they are unrighteous. They ignore God. They live without reference to him. They deliberately choose to live in ways which are morally corrupt. And why does it happen? It's because in their unrighteousness, they suppress the truth about God. Why is our world so full of things that you would say are wicked and evil and unrighteous? Paul says it's the rejection of God. And what lies behind the rejection of God? Paul says it's the suppression of the truth which can be known about him, deliberately and knowingly saying no to God. And if everyone has done that to the God of the universe, who made everything and owns everything, it isn't all that surprising that God would be angry. When we too can see how wrong it is when creatures rise up against their creators. I mean, imagine if machines created by us ever did rise up against us. I know there are kind of people out there who worry about artificial intelligence. I mean, what if the Roomba, right, that kind of, vacuums, thank you, I was going to say mop. There's another different robot that does that. Imagine if it kind of crawled up on your bed and tried to kind of suffocate you in the middle of the night. I mean, imagine if your car kind of carjacked you and took you somewhere you didn't want to. I mean, see, the wrath of God, it actually is more closely approximated by a scenario where if your children ever disowned you and denied you ever existed, that's when you might start to understand the wrath of God, his hot, just, personal fury directed at sinners. It's real, it's serious, and it's scary. It's directed at everyone, at your friends and mine, your neighbors and mine, your family and mine, who looks God in the eye and says, no. We need to take this on board. We need to take seriously that it's not due to the lack of facts or information, but this is happening because of a terrible choice, which Paul describes in the verses following, from 19 to 23. That they choose to say no to God, despite being created by him and accountable to him. Point two in your outline. Let's read verses 19 and 20. So God's wrath is being revealed, verse 19, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, been understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. See, according to Paul, God as a creator has made every human being aware of two things. his existence, and his power. Not every human being is aware of God's mercy and his love, but they are aware of his reality and his greatness. Now, Paul's not saying that you can come to know God and be saved without the Bible by just going for a walk in the national forest or having a swim in the ocean. No, he's not saying that, but there's enough in the world around us to be culpable. The world, it's limited, but it's undeniable, and it makes us accountable. And so what do people do? What do my non-Christian cousins, what do my next-door neighbours, what do they do? Well, they ultimately, what have they done? They refuse to honour God. They refuse to worship God. They refuse to thank God. They exchange the real God for all manners of substitutes. They choose futility and darkness and foolishness. Let's read on, verse 21. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools, exchanging the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like a mortal human being, and birds, and animals, and reptiles. It's tragic. Treating some animal, all right, or even worse, ourselves, as gods. So God judges them. God gives them over to the foolishness of their hearts to do what their hearts desire. Verse 24. Therefore God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. And that's what we see played out all around us. Why aren't your next-door neighbours Christians? Well, it's because they've exchanged the glory of God for a lie. Why aren't my uncles and aunts Christians? Well, it's because they've exchanged the glory of God for a lie. Why isn't that lovely bloke that sits next to you at work, who bends over backwards to make sure that you get on in the workplace, why does that bloke not believe in Jesus? It's because he's exchanged the truth for a lie. It's this terrible, deliberate exchange. It's this suppression of the truth that is all around us in every single heart that does not obey Jesus. And God terrifyingly just lets us have our way. He says, in his judgment, have it your way. Now, it feels like this section should have a warning label on it. Friends, if you are here today, you haven't been someone who honoured the God of the Bible as God in your life, who hasn't lived in thankfulness to him and him alone. If like me, for the first 20 years of my life, if you as someone who, you are someone who's looked God in the eye and said no, if that's you, then please know that you are in danger. You are under the judgment of God. No, we don't judge you, because Christians know that we're in the same boat, but for the saving death of Jesus that paid for our sins. No, there's no room for Christians to be smug or feel superior, because we're exactly the same without Christ. In fact, Paul's going to talk about this. He's going to address religious people and good people in the next 2 weeks in the sections that we're about to come to in Romans. But this serious and intense judgment comes from a God. If you're someone who has not known God, haven't really heard the gospel before, and maybe you're a bit riled up about this idea that he could be so angry at you, just know that it comes from a God who is serious and intense in his judgment, because you are loved by him intensely. That's why his righteousness is revealed in the gospel. A son was sent to warn you of the serious danger you're in. And he calls you to repent and believe in Jesus. And if you're hearing this, I'm so glad. I want to personally invite you to keep coming. Come to church. Keep hearing the gospel week by week. See how Paul explains the logic of this saving message. See how Paul reveals this God who cannot bear to see people like you, like me, lost and under judgment.
but instead sent his son Jesus to rescue us. Now, for others of us, who call ourselves and profess to be Christians, being reminded of this terrible plight for the people around us, and we need to hold on to that. Because let me say, there is actually a bit of a sidetrack in this little section here, and a possible distraction. And it's got to do with the biblical doctrine of creation. Paul's point is that God is the creator. That's why we are accountable. Right? It's not about how he created. The discussion between followers of Jesus about Genesis and the age of the earth, it's an important discussion to be had. And I know that talking with non-Christians, you very likely will have come across non-Christians who've said, well, evolution proves all this to be bunkum. The Bible cannot be trusted. So they discredit the truthfulness and the necessity to take the Bible seriously. Now, that's all needs to be addressed. But don't get distracted by that right here. Don't let that take away our focus. That Paul's point here is that God is the one we are accountable to. Let me say a couple of things pastorally, though. If you are a follower of Jesus and you're not particularly passionate or convinced about six-day creationism or young earth theory or any of that sort of stuff, you need to know that for Paul and the Bible, God is undeniably the creator. Never lose sight of that. However he did it, God made everything, and we're accountable. Yet, if you are convinced of that, along with a literal understanding of Genesis 1, you need to know that Paul does not rest his gospel upon that reading of Genesis. That if you look at the rest of Romans and 1 Corinthians 15 in particular, he rests his arguments on the literal and historical resurrection of Jesus. Now, wherever you stand, whatever the side of the debate you might be on, you need to have respect. You need to love your brothers and sisters in Christ who are on the other side of the fence. As you toss this back and forth, let me just urge you, be humble, not dogmatic. Listen to each other. Paul's point is that we are accountable to God, our Creator. Sorry for that little excursus. If you kind of have had a mental break for the last 3 or 4 minutes, now's the time to come back. Paul is saying God is our creator. And because we are created by him, we're accountable. And our rejection of him means that we're under judgment, rightfully. Last point on our outline, point 3. Paul says 3 times in the rest of Romans 1, those awful, awful words that tell us we're under God's judgment. Paul says 3 times, God gave them over. God gave them over. God gave them over. We already seen it in verse 24 already, the first subpoint in idolatry, the terrible exchange of truth for the lie of worshipping created things. Matthias, a few months back, kind of spruiked a book, a great book. It's called, I didn't write it down, I should have. It's by Tim Keller. Someone help me here. Not quite the prodigal God. It's about idolatry. Counterfeit God. Thank you, Dan. Great book. If you want to explore this idea of how is it that we exchange the truth for a lie and worship all sorts of other things, I don't imagine many people out there, perhaps some of your Buddhist, some of your ancestral worshipping Chinese, Asian neighbors might have a little idol. But I can tell you fairly confidently, it's not the idol that they're really trusting in. There's something else going. If you want to explore all that sort of stuff, if you want to explore how we can use great things and good things like even children and the good things like money that God gives us, like how we can turn those things into idols, let me just encourage you to read that book. I'm pretty sure it's up in the library as well, Counterfeit Gods by Tim Keller. Now, the next thing that Paul talks about that gets perverted as God's wrath is revealed is actually a healthy and a positive view of sex. Let me pick it up from verse 26. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Even their women exchanged natural sexual relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed shameful acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their error. Let me just make it really clear. This is what I understand to be the Bible's teaching. Sex, it's a good thing. It's to be enjoyed between a husband and his wife within the private confines of lifelong marriage. It's not there to sell cigarettes or cars. It's not there to market services. It's not there on public display to titillate. Sex is for marriage, and marriage is for sex. Sex is a wonderful gift from God, but like all God's gifts, it can be open to in the wrong context and used wrongly to gratify our own cravings rather than build up marriage like it was intended. And clearly for Paul, sex is not open to all permutations either, even in an adult consenting relationship. And that's just a reflection of God's nature in creating our sexuality to be an ordered sexuality. And as we go on here, let me sound another warning. Paul is clearly talking about, in his kind of sights here, is homosexuality. The issue of sexuality, and in recent years, homosexuality touches many of us. We will all know someone in our workplace, and our social circles, even among family members who profess to be LGBTIQ. And in churches, among Christians, there actually are people who suffer same-sex attraction. It does happen. What we don't need as followers of Jesus is to dismiss their complaints of having been vilified or picked on in the past or in the present. What we don't need is for us to make fun of it or look down on them as if those of us who struggle with opposite sex attraction, opposite sex lust, struggle with somehow a lesser sin. No, there must be no room for judgmentalism on the part of the church. If we're going to be taken seriously as and begin to make amends and be taken seriously as ambassadors of the gospel and ambassadors of God's love, let me just sound that warning out first. And so let there be no joking, all right? Paul says coarse joking as well, and he doesn't just mean of just one particular kind. Let's not belittle people who are different in sexual orientation to us. Let's just say that for a start, because homosexual sin is actually no different to heterosexual sin. They all call forth God's condemnation. If the church can't extend grace to sexual sinners, whatever form that might have taken, we've actually lost the heart of the gospel. Now, having said that, we mustn't delude ourselves. We have to see that there is actually a revolution going on here. There's a current fight in our society that pushes the boundaries of sexual norms. And it's a piece of evidence that the wrath of God is indeed being revealed against those who reject him. No, not that the penalty due mentioned in that last verse in verse 27, that penalty, it's not HIV or any other sort of sexually transmitted disease. Actually, in context, if you read it carefully, it just means the due penalty is the tendency that all sinners have of wanting to justify their own lifestyle decisions. They're under the same judgment of God, of living life their way. And so so when we see gay couples walking on the street, for example, it shouldn't be any different to when we see near pornographic advertising on Bow Desert Road. It was there for a long time last year. When we see people acting in any of the ways, in fact, that Paul will describe in the rest of the chapter, it should drive us to prayer for the mercy of God and to pray for opportunities to speak the gospel. Yes, for Paul, lesbian and homosexual practice is clear evidence that the whole world is out of kilter with God. But notice that homosexual sin, it's actually just one, and it takes its place not just beside heterosexual sin, but amongst a whole bunch of other sins and vices. Right, if you look at them in verses 28 to 31, it actually culminates with the crime of disobeying your parents. Every way of being that is counter to what God made us for. Verse 31, not having understanding, not knowing God, no fidelity, in other words, not being faithful, no love, no mercy. In every way that we've walked away from God, that all comes to us as part of God's judgment. And so the last subpoint there, depraved minds that have exchanged the truth for a lie lead to people who are depraved in their actions and their lifestyle. And it just gets better, doesn't it? Together, that leads to a depraved society. Verse 32. although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. People know what God said. But they not only ignore it, but they encourage it, and they even legislate for it. All in all, we live in a conspiracy of silence about God. And because of that, our world is under judgment. It's a huge sign that our world is under judgment. These aren't the simple kind of action-reaction of sin and its consequences. God is, in fact, giving people over to their desires in judgment. And that's where we are. That is our world. So if you're a follower of Jesus this morning, you must be asking the question, well, how do we cope with that? How do we live in this world? How do we love a world like this? Well, let me just say, I guess the really, really obvious. We need to start seeing our world like this. That this world is very much under God's judgment. We need this kind of biblical realism. Our family and our friends and our colleagues, our world need us to see it this way, in order for us to sound the alarm, because they are all in mortal danger. J.C. Ryle, English churchman, a couple of centuries ago, said it so well. A right knowledge of sin is at the root of all saving Christianity. We need to know what is sin in order to appreciate and be motivated to tell the gospel. How is the world going to hear if we do not believe it ourselves? That this world under sin is being condemned. How are we going to actually tell it to them if we don't even believe it? And of course, it's not enough to merely know. We need to tell people this message. It's a message the world does not want to hear, for sure. But if we're going to obey the great commandment of loving your neighbours, then we need to go ahead and tell people. Have you ever thought about it this way? Talking to people about judgment and hell, about right and wrong, is actually an expression of love. A great book on evangelism is this one, Honest Evangelism, How to Talk About Jesus Even When It's Tough, by a guy called Rico Tice. He's a British evangelist, and here's what he writes about what it means to love people. Evangelism is an expression of love. Let me just read a quick bit. It's all about love. My willingness to tell people the gospel is a test of my love for them. This couldn't have come home to me any more clearly than when I was playing rugby at university. I'd given a guy in the rugby team a tape. I'm old enough that it was a tape, not a podcast. He was probably old enough to have seen Terminator 2 as a teenager as well. I gave him a tape of a sermon that I preached. It was John 1, verse 29, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." I remember that in the sermon, I simply and starkly said that either we pay for our sin in hell, or the Lamb pays for us on the cross. This friend called Ed played my sermon one night to his housemates, who were in the same rugby team as us. And one of them, Dave, got very upset. He said, "If that's what Rico believes, the fact that he said nothing of it to me in months means he's not really my friend." So Ed rang me up and said, "Rico, you need to speak to Dave. He's upset that you've not talked to him until now about what's in the sermon." And Dave was right. If I'd really loved him, I'd have warned him about hell, shown him the cross, and invited him to trust Jesus and spend eternity with him in a new creation. It was a life-changing phone call. I found myself praying that I wouldn't only have a sense of God's love for me, but that I would have that same love for others. That I would love them enough to risk rejection in order to speak to them about Jesus and warn them about hell. Don't be deluded. Everyone needs Jesus. How do you love your neighbor? You need to tell them about Jesus, don't you? And the reality of judgment and hell. You need to tell people the gospel because it's the only fix for people who, in their own unrighteousness, are suppressing the truth. It's the only fix for people whose hearts and minds and lives have rejected God, who are under the terrible judgment of God. Friends, this is a really, really confronting part of the Bible. Really, really confronting part of Romans. But let's remember the context. This is Paul explaining his gospel. Let's remember verse 16. Let's not be ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God to save those under God's judgment. Dave's going to lead us in a time of prayer now. Thanks, Dave. And we're going to pray for Sunday school as well. If you're wondering whether we're going to do that, we're going to take some time to thank God for our leaders and also for our children to come to hear the saving message of the gospel week by week.